Welcome to The Layman. I'm your host, John Gabris. This is the podcast where I interview scientists as a layman, as a person who knows almost nothing about science, takes their ideas and dumbs it down enough for me to understand. Wink, wink, it's also for you to understand, but I'm not about to call you dumb in my intro to the podcast. But hey, we're not all scientists. That's a safe statement. When I was a young lad, about 4 years of age, I was playing in the backyard with a gypsy moth, which I guess is kind of offensive now, but it's like a caterpillar of sorts, and it was crawling on my hand, and my mom and dad were so happy. They're like, look at Jonathan, he's playing with a caterpillar, he's so brave. My parents walked away for a minute. When they came back, the caterpillar was gone. They said, Jonathan, what happened to the caterpillar? And I said, mouth. That, at the age of 4, started my love for insects. Not just eating them, but also playing with them, catching lightning bugs, running over a beetle on my bicycle. Just the kind of stuff a young suburban kid with the parents who work nights gets into after school. So for me, I've always loved bugs, and to get the opportunity to talk to a real-life entomologist, someone who's dedicated their life to understanding bugs, was a real treat. So I hope you enjoy my interview with Michael Wall, the Vice President of Research and Public Programs and the Curator of Entomology at the San Diego Natural History Museum. I take you now to the San Diego Natural History Museum. Dr. Michael Wall, the curator of entomology at the San Diego Natural History Museum.
You got it.
AKA the Nat.
The Nat. Very appropriate for a bug bug scientist. Yep.
Oh, man. You get to use that every once in a while.
Yeah.
Do you guys take like your Nat shirts and put a G in front of the N and be like, that's us?
That's us. We're the entomology crew. Yeah.
A, thank you so much for making time for us to talk. And B, thank you. We got a quick little behind-the-scenes museum tour. It's going to sound hyperbolic, but it was thrilling. I truly, my heart rate was raised several separate times, all from just looking at animals.
Yeah, we got some bizarre stuff behind the scenes. And it's often a surprise.
Yeah, if you think like dinosaur bones in full display, that is awesome. Wait till you see the shit they're not showing. Yeah, right. Literally, we saw a room that is full of jars of snakes.
Yep.
There's no other way to phrase that. Yeah. You said it's the world's largest rattlesnake collection?
Yeah, we have the world's largest rattlesnake collection.
Now, does that kind of bum out the entomology department where they're like, these lizard guys?
Yeah, we have in total more specimens than them. So that's the way we just say, yeah, whatever. We got more than you.
Storage is easier for you guys.
Yeah, right. Yeah, totally.
Yeah, you can only have one snake in each jar.
Right. Yeah. Yep.
Let's back it up a little bit. How does one get involved in bugs? Were you science minded as a kid? Was that something that always interested you?
Yeah, my folks took me out camping a ton when I was little. So I was always interested in like the natural world. And, you know, probably my interest in science came out of an interest in conservation.
Yeah.
And as an undergraduate, I bounced around between a whole bunch of majors and stuff like that. And
ooh, that sounds hard. Like, I was a communications major, and I bumped around a little bit, and it was like, now I have to take a film class or a radio class. Science seems like a weird one to bump around. It feels like...
Yeah, I started off in environmental science because actually I had followed a girl down to this school.
There's always a girl.
And another one comes in later. But then I switched over to wildlife science, which was too management oriented for me. It was all about deer and beaver and stuff like that. And then I ended up in botany, actually. So the study of plants. And that's actually what I got my bachelor's and my master's degree in. But I was always interested in like the interaction of insects and plants.
Yeah, that's something I just recently saw something about. I was watching something about bees, and I didn't realize how much plants require insects for survival.
Oh, totally. That's something we lord over all the plant science people. Yeah. Is how much they depend on us. Of course, they can always retreat back and say like, well, yeah, but we produce the oxygen you breathe. So
I can imagine a constant argument, and the guy who just studies manatees is like, don't forget manatees, and everyone's like, right. Sit down, Rick. The grown-ups are talking.
Totally. We do give all the the birds and mammals people a hard time for, yeah, you guys don't even, in terms of species numbers, you don't even exist.
Right, you know? Yeah, because it's just not, there's not as much.
No, no.
We saw like sleeves upon sleeves, drawers upon drawers of butterflies.
Yeah, right, totally.
Of just butterflies, of just something when you're a kid, you say, that's a butterfly. Well, I got news for you. There's a million things that are butterflies, a million different things.
Yeah, totally.
You're studying botany and you realize the interaction between insects and plants is so important. They both need each other so much and they're both so different.
Yeah. And that was kind of cool. So why I ended up in entomology was because I felt like I had I naively thought, I've got this botany thing down pat, you know?
I know everything there is to know about plants.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So now I'm just going to switch over to this entomology stuff. But it is cool kind of, knowing both sides of that story, because some of the things that I'm interested in are particularly like the coevolution of plants and insects. So you've got there's a lot of insects that specialize and only feed on certain types of plants. Well, as those certain types of plants diversify over time, so do all the insects diversify as well. And so you can kind of like trace back these family trees of plants and insects and lay them on top of one another. And, you know, sometimes they're almost mirror images of one another.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite fact? Like, what do you say when you have to hang out with the in-laws and have a cocktail, or, you know, or like you're at a significant other's work party and they're like, well, what do you do? And you're like, I'm a curator of entomology. And then they go,
Justify your existence.
Right. Well, as a comedian, the second someone says you're a comedian, they're like, tell me a joke. Right. It's the only job that you get requested to do at a party.
Right.
No one's ever like, cool, do you want to do neuroscience on me?
Right. Yeah. Mostly in those sorts of situations, the weird things that I get are people want me to diagnose their like spider bites or, you know, or some sort of blemish that they have on their skin or something like that. And the one weird thing that happened with that was, it was late on a Friday and I had this guy call me up and he was this total Southern California, like surfer bro kind of guy. And he's like, hey dude, I think my girlfriend's got a bot fly on her butt. And I was like, okay, well, what do you want me to do about that? You know? and I said, and our standard disclaimer for anytime somebody wants us to look at their body in some sort of way is that we're not medical doctors. If you have a specimen for me to look at, I'll look at a specimen.
Right, I'm in charge. I'm more bugs than butts.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Unfortunately, in this instance.
Right, yeah. And so he said, oh, well, we dug it out. I'll bring it into you. And so he met me at the loading dock. He hands me this little Ziploc bag that's got something kind of like, looks about the size of a pea in the bottom of it. And there's like blood in there and stuff. It was super gross.
I didn't have time to rinse it off.
Yeah, exactly. So he hands it to me. He gives me his telephone number. And I said, okay, well, I'll look it up in the lab. And I like, you know, totally disinfected it and looked at it, and it ended up being a sebaceous cyst.
So it's not a bug at all.
Yeah, it's not a bug at all.
So they dug just like matter out of her butt and was like, bring that to the bug guy we met at that bar.
And that's the sort of, when I tell people I'm an entomologist, it is like, well, how do I get rid of the roaches in my house? You know, it's all these like very applied, you know, things that I actually have very little knowledge of, because I'm about these kind of esoteric weird insects and describing new species and stuff like that.
Yeah, people don't really, like, I think Mitch Hedberg always had that joke. It's like, you're a comedian, do you want to be a writer or an actor? He's like, no, I'm a comedian. You don't ask a cook if he wants to be a farmer or a cow. He only does that one part of it.
And
it's like, to be have a doctorate in entomology and someone's like, hey, am I allowed to kill this kind of spider? Is this moth going to eat my sweater? It's like, we're doing something very different over here.
Yeah.
We just had our upstairs neighbor, like literally had the most cartoonish upstairs neighbors. They had like a roach infestation and were insanely loud.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't know about the roach infestation until recently. We started getting some.
Yeah.
And then we find out that they had like three nests in their apartment.
They were bubbling over into yours.
And they were just pouring out into ours. And I was like, oh, I'm going to meet with an entomologist tomorrow. And I was like, I'm not going to just sit here and be like, how do we kill roaches? Like, it's like, let's just let the exterminators deal.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I end up telling people. Yeah. It's because like they know how to do it better than I do.
Yeah, it's like asking a marine biologist about like flushing.
Yeah.
So my toilet water, does that go out to the ocean? It's like, what? Gosh. Do you have a favorite bug, or are you one of those people that's like, it's so hard to choose?
It's like picking my favorite child. You know. No, one that I always fall back on that keeps coming, rising back up on the list, an old standby, I guess, would be these things called Jerusalem crickets, which are another name for them are potato bugs.
Okay.
It's one of the things that we get the most phone calls about, because, you know, people call the museum and they want to know, like, oh, I found this bug in my yard kind of thing. And with that one, like, I sometimes play this game where, you know, I almost like name that tune. Like, I wonder how many words am I going to need to describe what this insect is? And for that one, people say like alien or giant termite is the words that I often hear, because they're about the size of your thumb.
Oh, wow.
And I guess it's supposedly it's what Jiminy Cricket was like modeled after. So they got this really big head, and it's in Mexico, they call them Los Niños de Tierra, the children of the earth, because it looks like they've got a baby's head. That's a stretch.
Potato bug is one of those terms I think people use blanket for like 9 different types of bugs.
Exactly.
Because I've seen the roly-polies growing up in Long Island, the little like what look like little armadillos more or less.
Yeah, pill bugs.
Yeah, pill bugs. They would call those potato bugs.
Yep.
And then I feel like potato bugs kind of extrapolated out. I was like, if I didn't know what it was just my dad. Oh, maybe it was just my parents. Yeah. Now, as I'm saying this, it's like maybe it's just my lazy parenting. That's another potato bug. Eat it. Go and get outside.
Well, so many of the common name type stuff, like with that, it's like, I was digging up my potatoes and I found this bug. Must be a potato bug, you know? So, and that's, you know, if you talk to any scientist or entomologist for very long, you get into this conversation about scientific names versus common names and stuff like that, because, you know, common names are, they're all over the place.
There's a reason that scientific names exist.
Yeah, exactly. It's
like, let's be slightly more specific than like big potato bug, little potato bug.
Right.
What makes you like them? Why do they keep coming back up to the forefront?
They are vaguely restricted to Southern California and Northern Mexico, so they're kind of special for our area. So that I kind of feel like they're the mascot of my department in some sort of way. They're just really weird and wicked looking. And then they've got this really cool natural history story that's associated with them, is that they can get infested by this parasite called a horsehair worm. And it gets into their body and it starts to grow and it starts to grow and it gets really, 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 really big. And then it sort of, but in order for it to complete its life cycle, it has to get into water.
Okay, I've seen this then. Yeah. I've seen this on YouTube. I've seen some variation of this.
Yeah.
It's haunting.
Yeah.
Right? That's when they put it in the water and then all of a sudden out.
Yeah, out it comes.
And it's like twice the size of the thing it was inside of.
Exactly. It's like a thread coiled up inside, like on a spool, inside of their body.
And then it comes out like a magician pulling ribbons out of his sleeve.
Scars out of their mouth.
It just keeps coming. Yep. And you're like, all that was in that poor little potato bug?
Oh. You know, these potato bugs normally don't like to go around water very much. And so what they say is like the horsehair worm kind of modifies their brain chemistry to make them feel like that they're thirsty and dehydrated. And so they go to the water and they can't drink enough water until they like eventually drown themselves in the water. So it's like this zombie crickets, you know, taken over by these weird worms.
That feels like zombieism or rabies or something that. Yeah. Affecting the brain chemistry. Parasite that affects your... God.
Yeah.
It's like Men in Black. I need more sugar water.
Yeah.
Oh, that's wild. And are potato bugs otherwise harmless?
Yeah, totally. I mean, they burrow underground, mostly feed on dead and decaying plant matter and stuff like that. I mean, if you held one in your hand, it might give you a little nip, but
I think that's like the marker of the coolest kind of bugs, is like you said, weird or odd looking and harmless.
Yeah.
Right. Like those are my favorite. Like I grew up, like once I learned that, like my dad would be like, usually if it's a huge beetle, and it's in the Northeast, it's in New York, it's fine. It's not going to hurt you. And I was like, oh, that makes them even cooler. Now I'm not scared of them, but I can watch how cool they are because they're huge.
Yeah. That's the intersection of your Venn diagram. It's got to be harmless and big and cool.
Yeah, exactly. When you're a kid, like, the second you're like, oh, this hornet looks cool, it's like, that will hurt you. You're like, I hate it now. I'm scared of it for 40 years.
Yeah.
Let's get to current time and what you're doing here now at the Nat. So we want to talk a little bit. I mean, I'm sure a lot of people in their hometowns or nearby in a major city have a natural history museum. We have one in LA. We have one in San Diego. The New York one is a pretty famous one.
Yep.
If you've watched a Ben Stiller movie, you'll know what I'm talking about. But What is the purpose of the Natural History Museum? You mentioned a few things that I was like, you know, I guess I didn't even know that. And I feel like that would be interesting for our listeners.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, the origin of almost all natural history museums was they were like a society of natural history, which means that it was basically a club of natural history geeks that got together to talk about science and natural history. And then eventually they would start developing collections. And then eventually they would go like, oh, we need to put all these collections in one place. Then they'd basically have a storefront. And once you have a storefront, it's like, oh, well, we should put some of this on display. And then it becomes a museum like right. that's available to the public. So really the root of all natural history museums are collections. But that's like the stuff that's behind the scenes that you guys saw. So most people who come to a natural history museum, they walk in, they see the dinosaurs and whatnot, but they don't even realize that behind the scenes, there's all this kind of these collections and their science and that stuff has value.
Yeah. Like the museum part is to bring in a little money to keep the lights on and to garner interest and
yeah.
education for a younger generation. But
totally,
you're doing a whole, it seems like we walked maybe just a few laps and we saw like, I saw like 9 different people doing all different projects. We saw the arthropod crew, shout out to the arthropod crew, doing some microscope stuff. We saw some people dusting off some fossils. We yep. saw a guy down in the snake room. Like there's so much stuff. You guys are doing things that are outside of just like, look at this 3D video of African safari or look at these big bones in the lobby.
Right.
Like, there's yeah. a lot of stuff going on here that's for the good of society and science and stuff.
Yeah. And in particular, you know, what's cool about natural history museums or what I think is cool about natural history museums is that we do have these collections that, you know, date way, way, way back. So we've like our oldest collections are from the 1870s up until, you know, contemporary time. And so because of that, we've got this like verifiable record of the past. And that's what science is all about, right?
Right,
is being able to repeat things and verify things. So we've got this verifiable record of the past. And some of the most kind of what I think are interesting and innovative ways that people are using collections now are, you know, to look at change over time. Like we have the study that's going on in the San Jacinto Mountains, which is that those mountains that are to your south if you're going out to Palm Springs in the valley of the circling turbines. 100 years ago, this famous naturalist was up in those mountains and just sampled the hell out of it. And we went back in 2008, 100 years later, to sample the hell out of it with the same intensity. And now we're describing kind of this change over time. And there's some things that like used to be on the tip tops of the mountains that aren't there anymore that have like gone locally extinct because, you know, the assumption is climate change, right? The
right.
tops of the mountains
it's
got
not
warmer.
As cool as it used to
yeah,
be.
Yeah, exactly. But then there's other things that are changing distribution in different ways. And so this kind of idea of being able to look into the past, I mean, it's in our name. We're natural history museums.
Right.
But you can do some cool stuff with it.
Like, for an example, like I'll try to boil it down to maybe oversimplify it. Like, you could look at a potato bug that someone got in 1908 and then look at a potato bug in 2008 and garner differences and then maybe make hypotheses about what happened to the entire area based
yeah,
on that.
Sure.
It looks like their diet may have changed or their color changed.
Totally.
Maybe their dust changed. You know.
Totally. And like one of the weird things that the group that's doing this study has been working on is this thing called stable isotope analysis. And don't ask me to explain it in gory, gory detail. But what you can tell from it is exactly what you just said. You can make some hypotheses about what the diet of things are by like chemically testing their fur or their feathers.
Oh.
When I say diet, it's like they were more carnivorous. They ate more grains than they
yeah.
did. And so even though we might not be able to physically see change between two specimens, they can like use these really weird techniques to actually learn about kind of the ecology of those animals back then, which is pretty far
that's
out.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
It's also crazy that like we're studying bugs here, but we also have collections of things that are 100 years old that we're still studying.
And, like, yeah.
That's wild. So
yeah.
like that sleeve of butterflies we saw is foreseeably here forever, right?
Yeah.
As long as it lasts.
We're in the business of preservation. And so everything is prepared in ways that, as far as we know, is indefinite.
That's wild.
Yeah, yeah. So every different discipline preserves their stuff in different ways to kind of maximize its livelihood.
Natural history museums are often focused on their local area. Like the big manatee we saw downstairs is from near here.
Yeah.
And are we to assume that the dinosaur bones are from around here and the mammoth bones that we saw?
And that's not necessarily all natural history museums. I mean, there are, you know, like the Cal Academy, for instance, in the American Museum of Natural History, they're kind of like, or the Smithsonian, they're natural history museums for the world,
kind
of thing. But we focus on Southern California and Baja California. So pretty much if you walk in our doors, almost everything you see, with few exceptions, is from somewhere in San Diego County or Baja California.
Oh, that's awesome.
It is kind of cool because, I mean, that means kids who come in here and, you know, with their school groups or whatnot, they're seeing stuff that got dug up, you know, possibly in their backyard. You know?
And I think that's really fun too, because that's something about museums. You're like, oh, cool, look at this art piece, look at this thing. It's like, just so you know, that came from here.
Yeah.
Like telling a kid, like, drive an hour in every direction, there's these dinosaur bones were somewhere there.
Yeah.
Like, that's wild. I mean, I think that's how you make anyone understand anything, is put it on their front door.
Exactly. I mean, there's this branch of science called conservation psychology. It's like, how do you make people have more of a conservation ethic? And one of the key tenets of conservation psychology is that you have to make it relevant to people's lives. Yeah. And so by focusing on local stuff, and also, you know, San Diego, much like LA, I assume, is filled with transplants, right? People who've moved here from wherever. I mean, I came here from back east, et cetera, kind of thing. And so if you want to encourage conservation ethic in an area that's filled with transplants, then you got to like really educate them and make them appreciate this is what's in your backyard. It's cool. It's important. It's awesome.
And it could all go away, people.
Yeah.
It's like everyone's like, I don't know. It's still cold by me. It's like, that doesn't mean global warming isn't happening for fuck's sake. I just opened my window and it's freezing here in Michigan. All right. Well, then you're fine. Keep spraying chlorofluorocarbons into the world. So I interrupted you. So you were doing a study in Baja, is what you were saying?
Yeah, we do a lot of, the museum in general does a lot of expeditions into areas that we consider black holes of science. So it's areas that where, because we can go into our collections and, you know, it's not just animals, the critters or butterflies or beetles on pins. There's those little tiny labels that tell you exactly where they were collected and when they were collected, et cetera. And so we can look through all that sort of stuff and figure out where we have things and where we don't have things, and then determine, you know, oh, this area is for us is a black hole. We don't know anything about this mountain range. And then that encourages us to seek the funding to go down and do these expeditions into those areas to document everything there and, you know, often find, you know, interesting new things.
So either like some new species or some variation of a, again, to go back to our potato bug, and it's like, oh, why in this mountain range is this potato bug different than that potato bug? Could you tell us something about its environment and ecosystem?
Yeah, totally. So the project we're working on right now is way down at the tip of Baja California. It's like in the area of Cabo and La Paz, and there's this big mountain range.
Oh, you have to keep going to Cabo for work?
Yeah, I know. It's a hard knock life, you know?
That's like the for those of you living outside the SoCal area, Cabo is like the Hamptons of SoCal. You like go to Cabo for the weekend and maybe check out the quote unquote black holes of science. We know what you're up to. Sipping a marg on the beach. Found another potato bug, honey.
You got it. But in the middle of that area is this really high mountain range that's a international biosphere reserve. It's acknowledged, like, you know, throughout the world to be special because it's got, it's this tall mountain that's totally isolated, and you can almost consider it an island. People call them sky islands, right?
Oh, wow.
And just like you have the Galapagos and the Hawaiian Islands, you know, anytime something's really isolated, you're going to have all this weird speciation that happens there and have unique things there. And so that area is actually well documented, but just like right north of that, there's a low ridge line, and then you get to another area where there's another small cluster of mountains, and that was the area that we determined was a black hole. It's called the Sierra Cacachilas. And so that's where we wanted to go because we considered, you know, kind of like, again, going back to the island analogy, if like the big island has diversity associated with it, then some of the smaller islands out the chain might also have some really cool diversity associated with it.
Yeah, that's why people study the Galapagos so hard, right? Is because it's so, it has its, like, there's been no real interference in its evolution or its ecology.
It's had low impact from humans, and also just like its distance from the mainland of South America make it so that kind of, it was a rare event for anything to be able to get the hell over there.
Yeah.
And so once something got there, it usually went nuts diversifying. So, you know, Darwin's big thing was he was interested in these finches. So probably, you know, I don't know the gory details of this. There's other people who have analyzed this to death, but, you know, presumably one finch got over the Galapagos Islands and then it speciated into, like, I don't know, 8 or 10 different finches, you know, all doing really weird things. And some of them look decidedly unfinch like because they're occupying a different niche. They might be have really, really pointy beaks to feed on something special as opposed to seed crushing beaks and stuff like that.
Yeah. So cool.
Yeah.
You're looking for that kind of stuff also in SoCal in these environments.
Yeah.
When you look for that black hole or the Sky Mountain or whatever, that's what you're looking for too. Is like, this has not been interfered with by people and probably no other potato bugs, just to keep using potato bugs, no other potato bugs made it to the top of this mountain. So let's look at,
And it's all, you know, in the name of, we might not say it explicitly, but I think it's in our hearts, that it's all about, like, documentation for the purposes of conservation, right? You know, and so the more people understand that different areas are special, you know, that are unique, that it, like, this is the Galapagos Islands of Baja California, you know, that's going to raise the gravitas of those areas.
People can wrap their head around that when they see that or hear that. Here's where the questions get a little sillier, and this is the stuff I'm very curious about.
All right.
What do a group of scientists that work together at a museum or a group of entomologists do for fun? Is there any, like, work thing, or is it, I know it's San Diego, so is it like, we all kayak, or we all stand up paddleboard? That's huge down here, right? We all drink craft brews.
Uh-huh. That would probably rank pretty high up there.
That's pretty standard for
any 21 occupation.
Up, 17 up. Yeah.
Right, yeah. You know, it is, as you would expect, it tends to be maybe more outdoorsy oriented things.
Especially amongst entomologists.
Cause
as someone who's married to an arachnophobe, I know that fear of spiders can really, really ruin an outdoorsy event.
Right. Yeah. So what we like to do when we try to do kind of like social events as a department is we go out and we blacklight, which means we go out at night and we set up a sheet, like string it up between two branches or whatever, and we hang a fluorescent blacklight from it, and that attracts insects into it.
And they all kind of like dance around on the sheet, and it's like a puppet show, like a shadow puppet show of bugs.
I thought you were going with some sort of satanic ritual of some kind.
Yeah. And then we put the newest member of the entomology department on the concrete slab.
Yeah.
Wait, what?
Yeah.
A couple of tarantula hawks.
Yeah. This is the initiation rites of all entomologists.
Welcome to the Natural History Museum.
No, it's just you go out and, you know, there might be some beer involved and you just look at what bugs come to the light.
Why are cockroaches known as, like, indestructible? Like, why do people say they'll be here long after we all are?
You know, I don't know if that's based on any sort of science whatsoever. I think it's just that they're in, like, every gross possible place that you can think of. So surely they must be able to survive the apocalypse.
Right. You know? Can actively try to get rid of them and they still will be around.
Yeah, exactly. But in terms of kind of, good things to not worry about or things to worry about, one of the things that I get phone calls about a lot is people will tell me, I've got bees in my backyard. And once I ask them to kind of describe it, they'll say, yeah, there's a whole bunch of them and they're hanging on this one branch and they can actually see the hive. It's not like they're coming out of a hole in a tree or out of their, you know, whatever, some sort of enclosed space. And that's honeybees. They migrate. I mean, basically they split their hive and half of the hive goes in one direction and half of the hive goes in, or actually half of the hive stays with the main hive. And when they're migrating, they're looking for a new place to nest, and they will just kind of rest on these branches. And it might be 24 hours, it might be 48 hours or something like that, but they will go away. And so you don't necessarily have to call, like, the bee removalist or something like that. So people get flipped out. I got dogs. I don't want these bees in my backyard and stuff like that. And they will typically go away. And then the weird thing, for whatever reason, when they are traveling is actually when they're at their most docile. So you don't even have to worry about them, like, flipping out and stinging you and stuff like that. You know,
That's exactly the kind of fact I was looking like, that's so cool.
Yeah.
What about when people say, like, don't kill spiders, they kill other bugs. Like, if you see them in your house, like,
That's pretty legit.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, let daddy long legs live. They're never going
to
bother you.
Yeah. I mean, I tend to be pretty, I don't know. I'm like, whatever works for you, you know, kind of thing. But
you're pro-choice.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. That, you know, if you don't want them in your house, then get them out of your house. It's no big deal.
Right.
You know?
It's your house, to be fair in the end. It's your house. Yeah.
Right now, there are these brown widows, which are related to black widows, and they are like venomous. And if you got bit by one, it would be, you know, it wouldn't kill you or anything, but it'd make you sick, and you might want to seek, you know, medical attention. And those are super common now outside of people's homes in San Diego. But they're an invasive species. They're not native to Southern California. And so whenever people talk to me about that and they go, yeah, but I guess I shouldn't kill them because they're, you know, they kill other insects. I'm like, no, you can go ahead and kill all them you want to, because, you know, they're probably displacing other spiders that are native and stuff like that. So
interesting. Yeah. Black widows are terrifying. That was the big move from New York to LA, was like, there are actual poisonous spiders. I don't know anyone who's been bitten by a black widow. I don't know anyone who's like, but I know that they are here. I see them sometimes.
Yep.
And my wife has me absolutely terrify them. And I like literally said to her the other day, I was like, do you know anyone who's been bitten by a black widow? We've been in California for 4 years now. Do you know anyone? No. Yeah, me neither. So maybe we don't have to go out and spray them when they're by the dumpster. Like, let them live.
So I'm going to be really pedantic. And you said poisonous spider, and this is something that totally rankles biologists, is the difference between poisonous and venomous.
Oh, okay.
So poisonous is like, if you eat it and it makes you sick, then it's poisonous.
Oh, if it
venomous
bites you.
Is if it bites you or stings you and it makes you sick, then it's venomous. And this is one of those like things that, like, you know.
No, that's fine. There's a version of that in my world, and it's when you call a comedy sketch a skit.
Oh,
like if you say on SNL, look at that skit. To comedians, a skit is something you do when you're hosting like a sixth grade talent show. Uh-huh. If you write it and act it and put costumes on, it becomes a sketch at that point. Yeah.
Well, I just wanted to take this opportunity to educate all your listeners.
Please, please. I will not be eating any black widows. I'm not concerned about their poison now. I'm more concerned about their venom.
You got it.
One of the things you showed us when we were looking, you showed us some of the displays that you show to kids, and they worked on me and Rob, the producer. We were super pumped about it. And one of them was the pain index, the bite and sting pain index.
Yeah, its full name is the Schmidt Sting Pain Index, and it's named after this guy in New Mexico, a scientist who studies bee, wasp, and ant venom. And over his life, he's been stung or has allowed himself to be stung. I don't know how much he allowed himself to be stung versus
how much was just part of the gig.
Yeah, it's just part of the job. But he's been stung by, you know, hundreds of different species of bees, wasps, and ants. And so he would always like diligently take notes about, oh, it kind of felt like this or it kind of felt like that, you know. And he ranked them all on the scale of 1 to 4. And so you got some things that, you know, I think the words that he used for the ones that are down at the bottom are like light and ephemeral and almost fruity, you know.
And they do read like a hot sauce, like Rob said, they're like a hot sauce description. And you mentioned it was like a wine.
Yeah.
Pain. Yeah. It was like an oaky finish to blistering pain.
Yeah, right.
It's like on tier one was like a couple of, tier two was like hornets, it looked like.
Yeah, exactly. So tier one is often what we consider to be native bees, which are the bees that don't necessarily live in hives and stuff like that. Tier two had like your hornets and your yellow jackets and honeybees, and those are all like social wasps that hang out in hives, and they tend to be more aggressive. And then tier three had some ants, and then these things called velvet ants. On the East Coast, actually, they call them cow killers.
Wow.
They don't kill cows, but I don't know, you know.
They can, though. Yeah. That's the thing, right? It's like enough venom to kill a cow. Yeah, that's awesome.
And then up at the tip top at number four are these things called tarantula hawks that hunt tarantulas, and they sting them, and it's very alien-esque. They sting them. They drag them back to a burrow. The tarantula is actually paralyzed. It's not killed. They lay an egg on it, and then the egg hatches and then burrows in and starts feeding on the still living tarantula. Like, I always tell people, it's fresh meat for baby.
Jeez, that's... And if you're wondering if the thing that hunts tarantulas is scary, the answer is yes.
Yeah.
Do yourself a favor, Google tarantula hawk.
Yep.
And well, of course, the thing that tarantulas are scary. And if you hunt something that's scary, you're going to like, oh yeah, have you ever seen that animal that eats sharks? Yeah. It's fucking terrifying.
Right. Totally.
oh, that poor guy has a very Schmidt has a very interesting career.
Yeah, he recently put out a book and I can't remember what it's called. Oh, that's going to kill me. But he recently put out a book and he's been on book tours. So I've seen him like on TV and stuff. He's a really interesting character. He's actually going to come give a talk at our museum later this summer.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Do you have any big bug events at the San Diego History Museum? Like, is there anything that you're like, oh, everyone comes out for Ladybug Month or whatever?
Right. Yeah. No, we often, like almost every month we do these things that we call family days, and they have different themes every month, and they're, you know, really geared towards parents with small kids, and every once in a while there'll be a bug family day, and it's usually fun for the whole family, as the name suggests.
We went to the Los Angeles Natural History Museum for my wife's birthday because they had a spider pavilion.
Uh-huh.
And she's like, this is my new, I'm going to try to get over it. We show up. We think we're going to see spiders in tanks and behind nets. It's just a huge room filled, and there's spiders in there.
Yeah.
No way, right? Like, the webs are just, like, straight across. They look like they were all, like, recluses and wood spiders. Like, so it looked like filament. Well, like, the web looked like wire. It was, like, so thick, and it was between. And they were, some of them were as big as, like, a fist.
Yeah.
And I was, like, and I walked through there, and there was, like, 8-year-old kids just like sprinting, like, tag, you're it. And I'm like walking in the middle with like my hands like this. I'm like tucking my socks into my cuffs and stuff. I was like, so I recommend that if anyone wants to live amongst the spiders. Like, even the volunteers that were, well, we later learned some were volunteers, some were obviously experts, but so like this nice lady was like standing under an umbrella and talking to us, and she was like, yeah, that one's called. And we were like, oh, do you study spiders? She's like, oh no, I'm terrified of spiders. As a matter of fact, this is my sixth shift and over the last couple weeks I'm sweating. And then my wife goes, watch out, because inside the umbrella is this big, and she's like, oh, she's like all scared. I'm like, if you're scared and you have the employee shirt on, I should get the hell out of here.
It's exposure therapy.
Yeah.
They're all going through exposure therapy.
I will say it was just a really cool opportunity to be that close to dangerous spiders and then leave alive makes you like a little more willing to get close to them going forward.
Yeah. Yeah, totally.
Do you have any scary bug stories? Do you have any?
Well, I don't know if it's, well, I shouldn't spoil it and say that it ends up being stupid, but when we were down in this area in the Sierra Cachalillas one time, we had gone into this like very shallow cave, really shallow cave, and found the exoskeleton of a spider. So it's shed skin, basically. And one of the people I was with, a spider expert, and he could tell based on the exoskeleton, whoa, this is in this certain group that's really rare. You know, I don't know anything from this group. We were like, okay, well, we got to come back at night because spiders often come out at night. And so we went back, and this is in a really remote area. And there was a little barbed wire fence around this little cave because they don't want the cows, I guess, wandering in there and stuff like that. And we're walking up and it's dark. And I said, you know, this is a point in all the scary movies where they say, like, we really shouldn't do this, you know, turn back now. But we go ahead and go in, and we're shining our headlamps around and looking around. And there was some water at the bottom of the cave. And all of a sudden this like drop of white fluid like drips down into the water. We heard the bloop and then shine our lights down there. And we could see this white stuff floating around. And we're like, oh, there must be a bat in here, you know, and look for it, see if you can find it kind of thing. And shine the flashlight up. And just as I shine the flashlight up, this bird like flew like straight at me. And I literally screamed like a little girl. I mean, it was like, you know? But we did end up finding that spider, and it ended up being a new species, an undescribed species.
Oh,
so that
wow.
was pretty bitching.
Wow. That's something I'd like to shift gears and talk about that for a second.
Yeah.
Cause that was something that people are still finding new species of, especially in the underwater world and in insect world.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, it's you know, I think right now they estimate there are about a million point two described species of insects, and the estimates are that the number of undescribed is probably anywhere from 2 to 4 million. So there's more out there that we don't know about than what we do know about, and then coming back to natural history museums, the cool thing is that a lot of those have already been collected and they're sitting in natural history museums, but you know,
just not officially given a title
or the right person hasn't put their eyes on them. You know, my specialty is a group called the Stink Bugs. You know, that's always popular with the kids. Yeah.
Your wife loves bringing that up at parties. Right. He's my husband, Mr. Stink Bug.
Yeah, exactly. So, but beyond that, like, you know, I could be looking right at a undescribed species of beetle and I wouldn't know it, you know, just because there's a million insects. I can't know every one of them, you know.
Right. You could say, oh, that looks like a Japanese water beetle. And then it's like, oh, it looks like a Japanese water beetle, but it's like, you know, 0.1 degree moved over.
Right.
And it's a completely different species because it lives in this climate versus that climate.
Exactly. Yeah.
When we're saying like, what can we learn from insects to take with us going forward? We haven't even learned, we've learned a third of it. Right.
Yeah. You know,
like, there's
yeah.
still so much more.
Yeah. And then like, you know, you think about, I don't know, rats or like some, like something that's commonly used in like science and labs and stuff like that. And we know like everything about them down to the nth degree. We have their entire genome sequence and all this sort of stuff. Well, like, I mean, for the vast majority of insects, we don't know diddly squat about them other than, you know, of those 1.2 million that actually have names, we know little to nothing about their biology because that in itself requires, you know, a whole lot of work. And there, I can't really
draw blood from most insects and then look at it. Yeah.
I just gave a talk recently about, it was called Breaking Bug, the insects as drug addicts, dealers and something, a pharmacist, because there's this whole line of research now on using like basically what they call prospecting for drugs in insects, and they're finding all these anti-tumor things and venoms and stuff like that. So
yeah,
there's all sorts of stuff that is out there that's just waiting for, you know, the right person to come along and do the right kind of analysis that could have some real benefit for humans.
Oh yeah. And then the second someone, you know, the second corporations find out you can make money in bugs, that's when all of a sudden you're pulling up in a Camaro with a license plate Stink Bug as you rip into your spot. Yeah. Because, and they're, you know, that's like, that's a double-edged sword of like, oh no, money and science is going to be so, but that allows you guys to really get those grants that we're talking about, study. Second, someone's like, wait, like you called it prospecting. It's gold. You know what I mean? It's like, if we find a bug that has pharmaceutical applications, we can make billions off of it. Maybe it's worth investing millions in looking at.
Yeah.
That's so sad. Like, you guys are doing such interesting work, but the best way to get money is to be like, you can make more money if you do. And then people are like, got it. Like there's a level of people that are going like, you could cure disease with that. And then there's a whole nother level of people going, imagine how much money we can make curing disease. That's the science versus businessman mix right there. Mike, thanks for taking the time to talk to us.
My pleasure. Yeah,
Dr. Wall, if you will. Dr. Stinkbug.
It's all good. Yeah, there we go.
Do you have any exciting things that you have going on that you want to talk about or plug? Do you have a,
you know, check out the museum's YouTube channel and check out our Facebook and all that sort of stuff. We do try to be really playful with things. We got this weird video on our YouTube channel where we did a reenactment of this Schmidt Stink Pain Index thing where I dressed up like I was in the 80s, and it's actually all filmed in that Kung Fury style.
Oh yeah. Like with the rolling bars throwing and stuff. That's really exciting.
So just check out our social media and you'll see lots of fun stuff.
Oh, that's awesome. Dr. Wall, thank you so much for taking the time. This is so fun.
My
hope
pleasure.
I didn't bug you too much. I'm sure that's what you get from like from all the brother-in-laws.
Yeah.
Close the window. We don't want to get any flies in here. I'm sure Mike would like that, huh, Mike? Yeah. Elbow. Well, that was a real nice interview, huh? I would say it registered a 0 on the Schmidt Sting Pain Index. Absolutely painless. Thank you, Michael, for giving me your time and showing me all your bugs. Oh, that sounds like something that could get me in trouble. But he showed me his bugs. On the next episode of The Layman, I interview Sarah Mills, a scientist working towards 3D printing human tissue. Yeah, we're talking about, finally, you can get those calves you've always wanted printed right on your legs. The Layman is a Stitcher original and a production of Midroll Media. My EPs are Chris Bannon and Jenny Radlett. My producer is the wonderful Rob Perra. And I am your layman, John Gabris.
This is Tony Rodriguez.
This is Carlos Santos.
This is Raiza Licea.
And this is Oscar Montoya.
When our powers combine, we are
Spanish Aquí Presents.
We have a brand new podcast here on Earwolf, bringing you the best of the best of lo mejor of the Latinx comedy.
Join us every Tuesday as we chat about what's going on in our lives, Latinx culture, and ¿qué es lo que?
Lo que nos está picando.
Lo que te pica. Don't worry, we'll tell you what that means if you listen.
We'll also be joined by a new guest every single week. We'll get to know a little bit more about their lives.
Every single week.
Uh-huh. And then we'll make them sit back and watch us improvise their lives right back to them.
Improvisation. Spanish Aquí Presents premieres July 16th. Subscribe now in Stitcher,
Apple Podcasts,
or wherever you listen.
O donde sea.
Spanish Aquí Presents.